Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com. We come to you online every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Like every week, I'm alongside my co-host, Fred Alvader. Fred, hi, how are you this week?
Hey, Carlos, I am fantastic. Really excited about the great guest we have this evening. Jim Nugent, founder and president of the Global Golf Coach, is going to talk about the AJGA and junior golf a little bit. And we had Steve Mona come and talk to us about the state of affairs in the golf world. That is really good stuff. We can't wait to hear that. And the LPGA Tour issued 45 new cards for 2015. 22 of those were new first-timers, Carlos. Jordan Spieth won by 10 shots at the Hero World Challenge, and Tiger Woods finished dead last, 26 shots behind Spieth. Ouch. At his own tournament. Let's go.
Let's go. And like you said, hey, we have great guests. We are reinforced for the subjects that we're going to be talking about. But as usual, we'll start with our Par 5 news. And Fred, there has something. You have something to talk to us about the Golden Bear.
You know, do you remember where? Do you remember where he's from, Carlos? I believe he's from Ohio.
I fell right into it.
You did. Jack Nicklaus won 73 PGA Tour titles, eight, including 18 major championships. He is one of the most prolific and recognized golf designers in the world, and even has his own golf tournament, the Memorial. He was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2005, and along with Woody Hayes, is one of the most famous Buckeyes of all time, and has attained nearly godlike status in Columbus, Ohio. The Golden Bear is about to receive another high honor, the Congressional Gold Medal, which is the highest civilian award issued by Congress. I know it's hard to believe Congress could agree on anything, but the bill passed and is awaiting President Obama's signature to make it official. Nicklaus said he is humbled and honored to be among those who have been awarded the medal. Since the American Revolution, Congress has commissioned the Gold Medal as its highest expression of national appreciation for distinguished achievements and contributions. The medal was first awarded in 1776, you remember that, I'm sure, by the Second Continental Congress to General George Washington. The first recipients were mainly military figures who participated in the American Revolution, the War of 1812, and the Mexican-American War. Congress broadened the scope of the medal to include actors, authors, entertainers, musicians, pioneers in aeronautics and space, explorers, lifesavers, notables in science and medicine, athletes, humanitarians, public servants, and foreign recipients. Past recipients include Rosa Parks, Robert Frost, Joe Louis and Neil Armstrong, as well as some famous athletes, Jackie Robinson, Byron Nelson, and Arnold Palmer. So quite an award for Mr. Nicklaus, among the many of the things that he has won over his lifetime is his achievements, and we are glad, we're very happy for him winning this award. And I think you're going to have you got a little bit to tell us about what Lydia Ko is up to these days.
Oh, yes, I do. But first, I also want to second that and congratulate the Golden Bear. Very well deserving that honor for him. Well, Fred, I just have to start saying co. Right? It's early Christmas for the golf young superstar Lydia Ko. She was recently named the youngest ever Rookie of the Year on the LPGA. She's ranked number 3 in the world, and she capped a stellar 2014 season by clinching her third victory up in Naples, Florida. She was the youngest player in the lead field, and she also claimed the circuit's inaugural Race to the CME Globe title and its $1 million bonus for the biggest payday in women's golf. Now, hey, she will turn to study psychology psychology. Oh, I can't believe it. At Korea University in Seoul from next year, starting in March. She was admitted to a psychology program through a special scheme for ethnic Koreans living overseas. That's what the university said. You know, she's a 17-year-old who was born in Korea and moved to New Zealand at the age of 6, and she completed all the education there. She's a rookie golf certification, and she says that she will have to learn to balance the demands of the LPGA Tour with her upcoming studies after being admitted to one of South Korea's most prestigious universities. She had long spoken about pursuing university studies before she turned professional last year, with one hope to emulate her idol, Michelle Wee, by studying at Stanford University. For athletes, but she will still be registered as a university athlete, however, and will complete courses online. Cole said her family had helped her cope with the demands of playing in the United States. You know, she has already captured 5 LPGA titles under her belt since she burst onto the scene in 2012, and then she became the youngest person to win an LPGA title at the age of 15. Last April, she was named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time Magazine. But despite that, she says that she has still a long way to go. Fred, studying psychology, she's already getting into the minds of the players. I think the players with her talent will need her psychology studies to try to treat with her.
I think she's already in their mind. They know when they're teeing it up on Sunday, if she's only within 2 or 3 shots of the lead, she's going to win and they're in trouble because she just beats them down. She's just so steady, man. I don't think she needs a psychology degree. But, you know, So Young Ryu got her degree while she was playing on tour. Michelle Wee actually went to Stanford. She played a little bit. She played a limited schedule, actually, for the 3 or 4 years she was there. But, yeah, good for her. I know she wanted to get her her degree, so good for her. Hope it works out well for her. You know, we have been following the creation of Mike Kaiser's new golf destination in Wisconsin, Sand Valley. And according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Kaiser has awarded David McClay Kidd the contract to design and build the second course at his Sand Valley property. McClay Kidd and Kaiser first teamed up to build the first course at Kaiser's Bandon Dunes, which has become one of the most visited golf destinations in the world. The first course at Sand Valley is being built by Coore and Crenshaw and is set for a 2017 opening date. Construction on Kidd's course will begin in the spring, and the course is expected to open in 2018. Kidd is 46 years old, the son of a Scottish greenskeeper. He has never designed a course east of the Mississippi River. He has done most of his work in Europe and in the western United States. Among his better-known designs are Castle Course at St. Andrews and Bandon Dunes. Ranked 8th on Golf Week magazine's 2014 list of best modern golf courses. He said he was blown away by the Sand Valley site and has routed 18 holes along and around a massive V-shaped sand ridge on the property. The ridge is 80 feet tall, all sand with craggy pines and oak trees. I already have a 10 out of 10 site. I don't have to do a whole lot to build a 10 out of 10 golf course. Must be going to be quite a place. One of his goals is to make his course playable for the average golfer. With a 12 handicap, I would like to build a course that from 6,300 or 6,400 yards, you would shoot 79 every third or fourth round, he said. You're going to think it's the best course you've ever played. Kaiser has said that as many as 5 courses could eventually be built at Sand Valley, though the number will be based on demand for high-end result golf in central Wisconsin. There's a lot of demand there, Carlos. You got Chicago not that far away, just maybe 2 and a half hours away, and a lot of money. A lot of guys go up into Wisconsin in the summertime to play golf. So it's in an area that really needs the development and needs the economic boost, and so that should be a really good thing going on there. You've also, I guess you're going to talk a little bit about St. Andrews. They're going to China or something. What's going on with that?
It's Yeah, they're going there, and also the Chinese are going to start getting to St. Andrews. You know, it's a sacred journey that has been made by hundreds of thousands of American golfers. Now the wheels have been set in motion for another mass of golf-hungry visitors, this time from China, to start descending on St. Andrews in the years to come. Chief Executive Yun Laudon claimed the decision by the Town's Links Trust to give the green light for its first overseas academy, which is being built at the Island Golf Club in Haikou and opens next April, had nothing to do with money. Hey, even taken at face value, this isn't strictly true, of course. You know, the Links Trust has already secured a signing fee. Then they will get another lump sum on a successful completion of the project, then continue to receive revenue-based payments. View it in a broader sense.
Show me the money!
Yeah, it's all about the money. The green ones. And I'm not talking about the green Hyundai. In one fell swoop, you know, the Links Trust, the charitable organization that manages the town courses, has tapped into the biggest growing golf market in the world. A timely move, too, given that direct flights from Edinburgh to Hainan are in the pipeline. You know, China already has 605 operating courses, of course, more than Scotland. Hey, they're like 20 times bigger than Scotland. And the surface has barely been scratched in terms of participation in a country that has a population of 1.5 billion. It is estimated that 1.5 million are playing only once every 2 months, and even the regulars, a 350,000 strong contingent, get out on the course just every once, you know, every fortnight. So it's expected to be growing, and by all accounts, the game so far in China, you know, it has been mainly influenced so far by Americans. Of course, in gated communities has been the dominant concept, along, of course, with mass development. But the approach being taken at the island, where a par 72 course has been designed by Tom Doak, the Americans' works includes the Renaissance Club in East Lothian, is totally different. And the man behind it is White Horse Holdings co-founder Xi Ding Han. He also owns the Golf Channel in China and is hugely respected and influential figure in that country. He wants to use the St. Andrews name with history and reputation as the model for educating Chinese golfers. According to Han, the Chinese have a bigger thirst for history than many other cultures, so he's confident they will lap up the St. Andrews story. And, you know, having strongly defended the use of the St. Andrews name in recent years, the Links Trust will no doubt be criticized in some quarters for allowing its brand to be used some 6,000 miles away. But, hey, on the face of things, looks like an outstanding piece of business for the town as a whole, especially with the big, big market that China is going to become in the next few years.
Yeah, with the golf business stagnant in the U.S. and also in Europe, China is the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and they are not even scratching the surface there, as you mentioned. We've had several stories throughout the year about the growth potential and things are going on in China, and I know we're going to keep hearing more and more about it. So, you know, Carlos, we always like to end the Par 5 news with a kind of a feel-good story. And and as you know, I am a huge John Daly fan. Not. But I am happy to But I am happy to announce that Big John won a golf tournament last week. No, you didn't see it on TV, at least not here in the U.S. It was his first professional win since the 2004 Buick Invitational. Daly has 5 career PGA Tour wins on his resume, including 2 major championships, the 1991 PGA Championship and the 1995 Open Championship at St. Andrews. He won the Beko Classic in Antalya, Turkey. That's the same area along the north shore of the Mediterranean Sea that is home to the Turkish Airlines Open on the European Tour and the Turkish Airlines Ladies Open on the Ladies European Tour. On Thursday last week, he had announced his engagement to his soulmate, a former promotions director for, wait for it, Hooters. Oh, he loves his Hooters. Just in case you're keeping score, this will make wife number 5 for JD. You know, if you don't succeed at first, try again. You know, good for him. Didn't he write the song "All My Exes Are Wearing Rolexes" or something like that? Despite shooting an even par 72 in the final round on Saturday, making him the only one of the top 14 not to go under par, Daly won the Beckel Classic by one shot. The tournament, played at Gloria Golf Club in Bellaca, Antalya, is sanctioned by the PGAs of Europe and Association of 36 National PGAs. Others in the field included Paul Broadhurst and Darren Clark. Daly finished the 54-hole event at 15 under par and earned a whopping $8,000 for his efforts. That will not cover his airfare and hotel costs, let alone an engagement ring. Carlos, I don't know how he's going to make that work. Maybe that's a volume deal. I don't know. But anyhow, that wraps up the Par 5 news for December 9, 2014.
Yes, that too. And, hey, he might not have earned enough. But I bet that if he's selling also his pants and wardrobe and all that, he can, get something back. So we'll see. Hey, like you said, that wraps up our Par 5 news. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we're going to have our VIG, very important guest of the week, Jim Nugent. Don't go away.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our VIG, our very important guest of the week. This week we'll have Jim Nugent. He's the founder and publisher of the Global Golf Post. Fred, how about this interview?
Yeah, Jim, in addition to his duties at Global Golf Post, has been on the board for the American Junior Golf Association, the AJGA, for over 20 years. The AJGA is the premier golf tournament schedule that college recruiters look at to find their people to fill their squads and give scholarships and all those kind of things. So they do a tremendous job, and they have some money to help kids travel to tournaments and all that kind of thing. And anyhow, Jim just did a great job talking about this, so can't wait to hear it. Let's roll it, Carlos.
We are so happy to have Jim Nugent, who is the founder of Global Golf Post, the leading digital-only golf magazine in the United States. And, Jim, we're so happy to have you here today to talk with us, and I just want to congratulate you on the great work you guys are all doing at the Global Golf Post.
Well, first, thank you for having me on, and secondly, thank you for your kind words. I accept them on behalf of a brilliant team that I've been able to assemble, who are dedicated toward keeping the written word, keeping journalism alive in golf as this digital revolution we're living through continues to work its way through the system. So we're very proud of what we've been able to accomplish. We're finishing our fifth year now, and we've got big plans for the future.
Now, you are also, you keep quite busy with the Global Golf Post duties traveling around the United States, but you've also been involved for over 20 years with the AJGA. Tell us a little bit about that, what your role is, how you got started with that.
Well, the AJGA, which stands for American Junior Golf Association, is the leading junior golf organization anywhere in the world. It is comprised of 6,000 kids age 13 to 18, the best players in the United States, and increasingly including members from outside the U.S., from all around the world. The mission and purpose of the organization is to take kids who have talent on the golf course and give them a pathway to earning financial aid to attend college. In some cases, it means the great big Division I world beaters like Duke and the women's side and Oklahoma State on the men's side. but it also can mean Harvard and Yale and junior college and Division II and III. So the organization is now more than 35 years old. In fact, we have alumni now playing on the Champions Tour. That's how long the AJGA has been around.
Wow, that is amazing. Roughly how many tournaments are held each year, and are they all season long from January to December, or is there, you try to space them when school is out, or how do you work that?
The great majority of the 115 or so tournaments that we will run are played between Memorial Day and Labor Day. Our focus is the summertime when kids are out of school and playing a lot of golf. We do have events at other times during the year, typically long three-day weekends like Martin Luther King holiday or Veterans Day in the fall. But for the most part, all of our events, which take place all across the country, are played in that 90-day summer window.
A junior golfer out there wondering how to get involved with AJGA. I mean, a lot of kids play in their local junior golf associations, and some of the better ones are looking for more challenge to get, like, jump into a bigger pond. How do they find the AJGA event?
Well, it's really kind of a word-of-mouth effort. You know, when a kid starts to play, he's probably got a club pro or a teaching pro who's helping him, and if he progresses, he or his parents start to ask around, what's the big leagues? Where do I go to play at the highest level? And ultimately they find their way probably to our website, ajga.com, which provides all of the information that a kid and his parents would need to join the organization and to progress. We have a number of kids that join us at a younger age. We don't accept playing members until you're age 13, but we have some kids that join us before that, just to keep an eye on the organization, to learn how it works, to learn, you know, what kind of scores you're going to have to post at different ages, how long the golf courses are, where they play. And it's a situation where basically skill is all that matters. We don't care what color you are, what gender you are, how big or not big you are. If you can get the ball in the hole, we're going to provide you plenty of tournament opportunities and the opportunity to play in front of college coaches and hopefully win some financial aid to go to school.
Yeah, you mentioned the college golf coaches a couple times or getting into college. And first of all, it's quite expensive for junior golfers and for the parents of junior golfers to have them maybe travel 2-3 hours away from home or 5 hours or from, say, Michigan to Florida or whatever to participate in an AJG event. And for children who are junior golfers who maybe need some financial support, you have a program that can help fund that?
We do. And first of all, to acknowledge your statement, yeah, the pursuit of golf, and probably this is true of hockey and baseball and basketball and other sports, it's expensive when you figure in the travel and all the associated expenses. So it's an investment by families, to be sure. It used to be that if you didn't have the financial resources, you were on the outside looking in. And we as an association felt that that was not correct, that if a kid had skill, had the ability to play, that he or she deserved the opportunity to play in front of college coaches. And so we, more than a decade ago, created a program called the ACE Grant, A-C-E, which stands for Achieving Competitive Excellence. And our point of view on this grant is simply this: if you can play, we'll get you to the tournaments, we'll put you in front of the coaches. And to date, we've awarded more than $2 million in grants to families to enable kids to come and play and earn college scholarships. And we have well over 100 such juniors who have come up through the ACE Grant program and gained a college scholarship of one form or another.
And you mentioned to me that, you know, not everyone receives some kind of financial aid, but a majority of your golfers that come through your program attend college and go on to play collegiate golf at some level, whether it be D2, D3. And the golf coaches actually watch your results, come to your tournaments, watch the kids play, and recruit to their programs from that.
This is the AJGA is a college coach's best friend, and if we hadn't created it some many years ago, I think the coaches would have done so themselves. Prior to the AJGA, there was very little national competition outside of a handful of events and the USGA Junior Championship. Over the years, this has become almost a crutch for the college coaches. This is what they lean on when they're recruiting. They're watching the results online. They're attending the tournaments. They're talking to the kids when it's permissible to do so. They're talking to the parents when it's permissible to do so. This is the recruiting ground for kids who want to play at any level. Certainly the big D1 schools for men and women, but also D2, D3, junior college. This is where they find their prospective student athletes.
Yeah, I've known several kids that have gone on to get scholarships, go on to play college golf, and they all excelled at the AJGA level and attended those events and participated. And you guys do a great job. They're very well run, very well organized. You've been doing it for a while, so everyone knows what they're doing, and it's just a great, great program. Would very much recommend any top-flight junior golfer to look into the program, into the AJGA, and maybe try and get into one or two events next year or as you're a freshman, sophomore, as you work up through high school, that will really help your game and kind of open your eyes what you need to be working on with your own game. Jim, yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
We also provide a service to the parents because it's the rule rather than the exception that most parents don't come from golf. They don't necessarily play it. Their kid found it on their own. And so mom and dad, when it comes to, you know, the process of using golf to get into school, they're largely clueless. And so a lot of our services are aimed at the parents to help educate them, to tell them how the process works. We have programs in place whereby we can help the parents pick the level that's appropriate for their kid. Or if you're, you know, in the top 10, it's obvious that you're going to play at the high level. But if you're ranked number 100 in our rankings, what kind of school should you be thinking about? So we serve the parents as much as we serve the kids.
Yeah, that's really good stuff. Before I let you get away today, I have to mention that the article and your this is the second year of presenting the Amateur of the Year awards, and I think you recognized about 200 and some amateurs from around the world, not only junior players but mid-ams and seniors in countries from all over, not just the United States. But your top two picks this year were Mariah Stackhouse from Stanford and Al Fidel, who is from Toledo, Ohio, and was the U.S. Amateur Championship medalist this year, and he's been playing golf for a long time. So the symbolism to me, and Steve Eubanks wrote a great article in the GGP last week about here you have completely diverse cultures, a 20-year-old African-American woman still in college, a 60-year-old senior golfer who's been playing for a long time and is a country club type situation that everyone would think of, and just demonstrates how golf is open to such a wide diversity of cultures and has a place for everyone.
Well, our game is becoming more diverse as each day goes by, reflecting the increased diversity of the population of America. We thought these were two outstanding choices, but we also thought at the end of the day these were two easy choices. Alan Fidel has played at a very high level for almost his entire life, but he has given a great deal back to the game, and no more so this year when he created a new international competition for mid and senior amateurs called the Concession Cup. It was a great idea. It was brilliantly executed. Hopefully it's got a long shelf life, and Alan Fidel will always be known as the visionary and founder of that tournament. Mariah Stackhouse, who grew up with us in the AJGA, actually served on our board, is a bit of a barrier breaker in that she was the first African-American woman to play on the United States Curtis Cup team. She's a dynamic individual. A quick story about her. She, as I mentioned, sat on our board. She was the player representative on our AJGA board several years ago. and as her term was coming to an end, as she was about to sail off to Stanford, the executive director of the AJGA remarked that he couldn't figure out if she was going to become a great LPGA player or a future president of the United States, or maybe even both.
I've said it over my whole life that the people you meet on a golf course, you know, if you just go out as a single and you get paired up with someone on the golf course, I very seldom, you know, maybe twice in 20 years, have gotten paired up with people that I didn't really enjoy getting to know and talking to over the course of the round. And this just shows, the communication and the conversations and how golf can bring people together. It's really good stuff.
It is a remarkable game in that respect, and I think that all of us are stewards of the game. We're to pick it up and hopefully leave it better than we found it.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you so much again for coming on and talking to us. We really appreciate and enjoy the Global Golf Post each week and the daily posts that you put out. And your work with the AJGA has been outstanding, and hope you continue that and wish you all the best.
Thank you, Fred, and thank you for having me on today. I appreciate it.
There you have it. That was the interview with Jim Nugent, the founder and publisher of the Global Golf Post. And Fred, I would like to go ahead and put on now the segment for our practice range. We taped it earlier this morning with Steve Mona so that we can get it on the time we have. So, Fred, I'm going to go ahead and we're going to start our practice range, and I'm going to put right now the segment with Steve Mona.
The practice range. Fred and I always tackle the topic of the week, but this week we want to discuss the current state of affairs in the world of golf, and as our topic of the week, with one of the people responsible and involved with the direction golf at the highest level of the sport. For that, we need a big reinforcement, and for that, we're more than happy to welcome the CEO of the World Golf Foundation, Steve Mona, who joins us on Backline Report again as we bring 2014 to a close. Steve, hi. Welcome to the show again. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, Carlos. It's great to be back with you and Fred.
Thank you for being with us again. Hey, Steve, one question. With the economy in the U.S. on the rebound, are you seeing the growth and increase in activity for golf courses and products following along with that general trend? And can you give us an overview from your standpoint of where golf is at right now and where is it headed in the immediate future?
Okay, well, with respect to what have we seen in view of an improving economy, we've seen golf improve as well, and I base that, on a couple things. First, rounds played. This is through October of this year, but rounds played are off about a percent and a half overall. But in the private club sector, they're actually up 0.4%. So we feel like we've seen stabilization at that level in terms of rounds played. Pardon me. Now, with respect to where we see the current state of the game more at a macro level, we really view, if you look at golf holistically, we view golf as a quite healthy sport. And we already talked about participation, and it's a little off, but generally we view it as flat. But if you look at it from a fan perspective, a spectator and general interest perspective, it's really quite healthy. If you look at it from the standpoint, take the LPGA Tour. It's added a couple of events in 14. It has a new event coming up in 15. It is playing for more money than it ever has, as an example. PGA Tour, a lot of the same. The purses are at all-time highs. If you look at cumulative viewership on the PGA Tour, it's remained steady. So golf as a entertainment and fan and spectator business, if you will, is actually doing quite well. And then the last piece I would mention is at a retail level. PGA Tour Superstore this year announced that it was going to double its amount of stores throughout the country, number one. And then Golf Tech, which is actually in the instruction business, announced during the year that it was going to hire an additional 100 PGA professionals to teach at their facilities throughout the country. So we view that as robust signs of a healthy sport.
It's great, and always we look forward to see all the initiatives to grow the sport of golf. And last week we talked with Joe Louis Barris Jr. of the first week of the First Tee. You know, the First Tee has been hugely successful since its start in 1997, and he has some very lofty goals for that organization over the next 4 years. You know, the World Golf Foundation oversees the First Tee, so can you give us your perspective on it?
Well, the First Tee has done phenomenally well since it launched in 97, as Joe, I'm sure, said. And what he's talking about specifically is the recent goals that we've established to reach 10 million young people between 2012 and 2017. And as I'm sure he mentioned, we're well on the way to achieving those goals. And there's a couple things specifically that I think are worth mentioning. First is that the First Tee is very entrenched now at the school level. And through the National Schools Program, the First Tee now is offered at more than 7,000 elementary schools across the United States, teaching golf as part of the PE curriculum to elementary school age students. And we view this as critical because our view is as these young people get exposed to the game, they'll take it up as they get into a position a little bit later where they can physically take up the game. And then number one and number two, we also think that can help bring their parents to the game. So that's critically important. And then the other piece that I think should be accentuated is the First Tee, besides being a junior golf program introducing young people to the game, it's also a youth development program teaching life skills and teaching healthy habits. So our view of the First Tee is it's not only a junior golf development program, it's also a youth development program. And we are actually creating not only the next generation of golfers, but the next generation of leaders in the United States as well.
Yeah, the First Tee has been wildly successful. I made mention last week that when it was, started to be talked about back in the mid-90s, I thought, well, once they got it going, it would be one of those things that would go for a couple of years, kind of run out of money and gas and go by the wayside. But it's really gained momentum. It's like the snowball. It's really doing a great job. So, hey, Steve, let's switch gears here a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about the World Golf Foundation initiatives. I know one of your pet projects is environment, and we've seen a lot of controversy over the golf course in Rio de Janeiro. And I know talking to some golf course architects that what they have to plan for today when they build a golf course is a lot different than what they did 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, there's no question about it. And sustainability is one of the key areas that we're focused on, not only as the World Golf Foundation, but also the golf industry generally. So it is part of our overall strategy with respect to what we're focused on as an industry. Now, specific to Rio, obviously you have different sets of laws and different sets of regulations country by country, and that's what we're trying to deal with in Rio. I'm confident that we'll get all that worked out. The other thing I would say is that I can assure you that from an environmental and sustainability standpoint, that golf course is being built to the highest standards that you could possibly imagine. So you have my assurance that that golf course from an environmental and sustainability standpoint is going to be right at the very top in terms of any new facility that's been built. So that's one piece. The other piece that should be mentioned is we really had during 2014 an historic moment when the U.S. Open was played back-to-back men's and women's opens in consecutive weeks at Pinehurst. That was historic, number one. But number two, look at the golf course at Pinehurst number two. And I'm quite sure that the viewers in America and worldwide never saw a U.S. Open, at least in modern days, or a women's open course look like that. And yet it played beautifully. It produced great champions. And I would say that is what we need to start thinking about in terms of the future of golf. I don't know if it's going to be 10 years. I don't know if it's going to be 20, 30, But there will come a day where our golf courses will look a lot more like Pinehurst number two. And I think that's good for the game ultimately. So I applaud the USGA for taking it to Pinehurst, meaning the men's and women's opens, to Pinehurst number two, and for presenting a golf course that looked like that.
One of your driving goals is to grow the game of golf. I mean, that gets a lot of lip service from everybody. You know, as everybody knows, a lot of people have gone away from it for various reasons. But one of the things that is in your niches is the image of the game. And how do we get that image of the game and bring young people and women more, get them more involved in the game and bringing them up through becoming golfers?
Well, the key piece with respect to bringing, and you mentioned a couple of groups, women and young people into the game, that would be juniors, millennial age people, is that they have to be made to feel welcome, is really what it boils down to. We did some research earlier in the year, late 13, early 14, and it was really clear that people want to play the game. There's a high percentage, besides the 25 million who play it, there's almost an equal amount who indicate a pretty strong desire to take up the game. But one of the things that holds them back is they think that they're going to be made to feel unwelcome when they show up at a facility. So we have to make sure that people, particularly those who generally aren't represented in the game in big numbers, that would include women, 20% of golfers who play the game regularly are women. But as you know, 50% of the U.S. population is minorities. 21% of the golf population are either African-American, Hispanic, or Asian, but 37% and growing every day of the U.S. population are from those three groups. So, and in the millennial group, the millennials actually represent 25% of the U.S. population and also 25% of the golf population, but they're not playing as much golf as the baby boomer generation before them did. But be that as it may, the bottom line is that if you want people in your sport, then they have to be made to feel welcome. And that is a major initiative of the golf industry. So it's really a twofold process. One, you have to get people interested. We've been successful there. Two, you have to get them to try the game. We've been fairly successful there. We could do better. Three, you have to get them to stay in the game. We have not done well in that regard, and that's where we have to get better. And it all starts with creating a welcoming environment and creating fun in the game, particularly for groups that don't really see themselves as part of the game.
In your points there, you make mention of kind of diversity. You know, we're talking about young people, we're talking about women. We're also talking about diverse cultures. And another of your initiatives is to make sure diverse groups are included in golf conversation. And we saw that Global Golf Post kind of took the bull with both horns in their choosing of Mariah Stackhouse, a young African-American woman, and Al Fidel, a Caucasian senior golfer, as their Amateurs of the Year this year. I thought that was really a brave step, and really, I think that's really a strong sign for the industry.
Oh, yeah, I agree, and I applaud Global Golf Post for that. What it really tells you is that a couple things. One, that golf is increasingly becoming more diverse. And two, it's creating champions from diverse backgrounds. And we need to continue to push and focus in that direction. The other thing that we know, and again, the research shows this pretty clearly, is that young people generally are going to take up the game based upon their heroes. And if there are people who look like, say, young African American or young Latinos or young Asians growing up in our country, if there are people playing at the highest levels of the PGA and LPGA tours who look like them, they're going to be more inclined to do that. And then number two, if there are people from other sports or walks of life who look like them, i.e., say, professional sports, but other sports than golf, but if they play the game recreationally, they'll be more inclined to try it themselves. So that's critically important, to have heroes that look like the groups that we want to bring into the game. And so Mariah Stackhouse we can only hope will become that on a worldwide scale as she proceeds in her career.
Let's switch gears again here. We saw a new selection process for the World Golf Hall of Fame this year. Laura Davies, Marco Mira, David Graham, and A.W. Tillinghast will be inducted in July at St. Andrews just ahead of the Open Championship this year. Did this new selection process meet expectations? And talk about moving the induction ceremonies outside the U.S. for the first time.
Sure. Well, I'll take them in order. First, there's no doubt in our mind that the new selection process worked. And that is proven by the class that we selected. And I believe that it's been universally applauded as a class in many people's minds that maybe should have been, several of those people should have been earlier. You could debate that, but the fact is they are coming in, and that's what matters most. There's a few little nuances that we have to tweak. We have a board meeting actually later this week, and we're going to take that up during that time. We'll make some improvements. But in terms of what the public sees, we feel very good about where the process is right now. And I think if you were to talk to current Hall of Famers, and those folks in the main were some of our harshest critics, I think you would find that they are pretty much universally pleased with the changes and like the direction that the whole induction process is taking. So that's point one. Point two, with respect to the decision to, well, there are really two decisions. One was to go every other year, and two was to rotate the induction ceremony around the world rather than have it here at the World Golf Hall of Fame the Monday of players each time. There were two thought processes. One, much like the Ryder Cup, much like the President's Cup, much like the Solheim Cup, Curtis Cup, Walker Cup, et cetera, we felt like to go every other year would create greater prestige, greater build-up to the actual ceremony itself, and we didn't feel as if it would prevent people who should be in the Hall of Fame from getting in the Hall of Fame. So that's why we went to every other year. And in number two, on the decision to go worldwide, this is the World Golf Hall of Fame. It's not the United States Hall of Fame, and certainly not the St. Augustine Hall of Fame. And so we said, look, in order to bring this institution to other parts of the world, we need to essentially take it there. And so just think about having the induction ceremony the Monday of the Open Championship at St. Andrews, and just think about that for a minute. And then 2 years later, we come back to St. Augustine the Monday of players, and there's one Tiger Woods, who probably is a pretty likely bet to be coming in then. And then in 2019, we go to Pebble Beach to have the induction on the Monday of the U.S. Open. So we think those are three pretty good ceremonies. But more importantly, it's bringing the induction to parts of the world or even the country that previously wouldn't have had any exposure to it.
You better be careful, Steve. You're already putting Tiger in the Hall of Fame. He'll be mad at you.
I think that's a pretty good bet. I'm willing to go out on a limb on that one. That's the only time you'll hear me make a prediction, by the way. But I feel pretty good about that one.
Yeah. Hey, one last point here. Women are assuming a larger role. You touched on bringing women and juniors into the game. But women are assuming a larger role, not only playing the game, but being involved with the golf hierarchy at the highest levels. And, we've seen Augusta National just accepted their third female member this year. The RNA voted to include women members. The PGA of America just elected Susie Whaley to an executive position that should lead to the president's chair in 2018. So what are your feelings on this inclusion of women at the highest levels, and what discussions do you get involved with your board and with the other people that you interact with on this issue?
Sure. Well, first of all, what do I think about it? I think it's terrific. I think you can make the argument that it's overdue in all cases, but let's set that aside for a minute and let's just focus on where we are. And I think all three of those examples you mentioned are great examples of how golf is trying to become more inclusive. And it really feeds into a larger point, and that bridges more into your second point, and that is how much do we discuss this at the highest level? And the answer is very, very frequently. We have a goal we want for golf to look like America looks. I'll just speak to the United States right now. And we want it to look like America looks from a gender perspective, from an ethnic perspective, from an age perspective, disabled perspective versus able-bodied, et cetera. So our view is that if golf could reflect and be somewhat of a mirror image of what society looks like, then we'll achieve our full potential as a game. The facts are, in just about most industries except for, quote, the male, traditional male industries, of which there aren't very many left, women are increasingly, if not the majority, close to it. And yet golf isn't there from the perspective of the people who work in the game at the highest levels and certainly those who participate in the game on a recreational level. So we're very focused in those two areas. We have, I thought I'd mention just very briefly, we have a diversity committee within the World Golf Foundation that's working on diversity matters. We already talked about that. But we have also have a women's committee within the World Golf Foundation that's working on women's issues. And they're principally around getting women, and I'll bring diversity into it also, minorities into top jobs in golf, and then number two, to bring more women and minorities into the game at a recreational level. You'll see in early 2015 the launch of a website that'll be dedicated exclusively to women's golf that we hope will turn into the hub for all things women's golf and create a place for women to go, and then it, from there they can go to other websites and other places to get their specific needs met. But we think this will be a real jumping-off point to help drive greater interest and participation in the game among women.
We are certainly going to look for that, and again, we want to thank you for taking time to talk to us today. And Carlos, do you have anything else before we let Steve go on about his day?
No, I think it has been a very insightful interview, as always, and our fans and our followers always enjoy your insight in the world of golf. So, Steve, we want to thank you for your time again, and hopefully we can do it again next year.
Well, I hope so, Carlos. Thanks for having me, Fred. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to be with you gentlemen, and we'll look forward to a great year in 2015 for the golf industry. Hopefully when we talk again, we'll have a lot of good positive news to talk about.
Fantastic. Thanks.
Thanks.
That was Steve Mota, the CEO of the World Golf Foundation. Fred, always, always a great insight and all the numbers, all that information that Steve brings. What an interview, always. And great section on the practice range to bring him on. We covered, I think, everything there.
Yeah, the topics, really the hot topics in the world of golf today, especially the inclusion of women and how to bring juniors into the game. And, you know, he has the numbers. You know, I mean, he interacts with the Tim Finchems, you know, the Pete Bavakwas, the George O'Grady's, and the Mike Davis's of the world on a daily basis. So, I mean, he's at the cutting edge of what's going on in the golf world. And with all these organizations, with all these people coming together, and just his insight and wisdom and the information he can bring, really, really good stuff. We're so lucky to have him as a friend of the show.
Definitely. I was just going to say that it's great to have him. It's the third time that he's been with us, and hopefully next year we'll bring him on. And like he said, we'll have a lot more to talk about, and hopefully positive things. The world of golf is really moving fast. And, hey, let's spend the last 6 minutes talking a little bit about some other things. And I know you have a couple of stories that you want to bring in, but and I know you're going to talk about Jordan Spieth, but I just wanted to mention some things just to set it up. Whatever he drank there at the Manly Opera House, or if it was Cameron McCormick's lessons with his putting, or whatever it is, I mean, his back-to-back wins against some elite competition, even though they were neither of them official PGA Tour events, have been amazing. I mean, he won by 10 strokes, breaking Tiger Woods' record there at the Hero World Challenge Tournament. Pardon, and he beat Tiger by 26 at his own course. Man, that's not nice, you know. It's not good. And 16 is the number of strokes that he has won bye in his consecutive starts. 63 he shot in the final round of the Australian Open, and Rory McIlroy said that he wouldn't have been able to shoot that on that course in those conditions if he was given 100 tries, okay? So that could tell you how good he played that day. 34 is the amount that under par the speed is in his last five rounds. He jumps to number 9 in the world golf ranking for the first time in the top 10. And remember, he did it flying now 9,000 miles from Australia to Florida. What are he doing? Wow, I want some of that, Fred.
Yeah, that's pretty good stuff. And like you say, even though they're not really official events, you know, you still got to get the ball in the hole, and you're still playing against some pretty good competition. I think Adam Scott and Rory McIlroy were in the field down there in Australia, I believe, last week. And then you had 17 other pretty good names in the field this week. Bubba Watson, Henrik Stenson, Ricky Fowler, Justin Rose, just to name a few. So, phenomenal, phenomenal stuff. Couple things real quick, Carlos. Next week will be our last show of 2014. We are so excited. Kieran Carrick is going to come in and join us. He's going to come back from his sabbatical, and we're going to talk about the top golf stories of 2014. We're going to cover everything. So can't wait to get Kieran back and do that. As always, you can catch it on Blog Talk, iTunes, TuneIn, or GNN Radio. Global Golf Post picked Stacey Lewis and Rory McIlroy as their players of the year. Of course, Rory won the two majors, plus the WGC Bridgestone, won the race to Dubai. Stacey won the LPGA Tour money title, the Vera Trophy, was player of the year for the second time in the last 3 years. She had 3 wins throughout the year, 18 top tens and 28 starts, and led the race at CME Globe for most of the year until Lydia Ko slipped in there right at the very last week and knocked her out of that. We talked about Jordan. As you know, Phil Mickelson has been spending some time helping his brother Tim as an Arizona State University assistant golf coach. Can you hear this recruiting call to some unsuspecting high school kid? Hi, I'm Phil Mickelson. I'd like to invite you to come to the ASU campus and play a little golf with us. Who's going to turn that down, right? Well, Phil announced he will start his 2015 campaign at the Umana Challenge the last week of January, and will also play the next week at the Waste Management in Scottsdale. By the way, Phil must have been giving his younger brother Tim some golf tips, because Tim and his partner Jake Younts shot -8 under par 63 at Poppy Hills to qualify for the USAM Four-Ball Championship to be held at Olympic Golf Club in San Francisco in May. Tim Mickelson is 37, 7 years younger than Phil. He has enjoyed some low-profile success. Most notably, he reached the U.S. Mid-Am quarterfinals in 2007 and 2010. 45 ladies earned LPGA Tour cards for 2015, including Minji Lee, who was co-medalist with Allison Lee. Aria Jutanagarn was third, one shot back. Ryan O'Toole got her full membership back. She was a member of the Solheim Cup team a few years ago. Charlie Hall and Stephanie Meadows also earned conditional status, so we will see them on the LPGA Tour next year. And this week TV this week, Carlos, we got the Franklin Templeton Shark Shootout from down in Naples. We've got the PNC Father-Son Challenge. Jack Nicklaus headlines that with son Jackie. The European Tour stays in South Africa for the Alfred Dunhill Championship at Leopard Creek. Always fun to see the television pictures of the Leopard Creek big sanctuary there with all the animals. It's like a zoo, only except it's real. And then the Ladies European Tour has a big event, the Omega Dubai Ladies Masters. It's a high-profile past winners include Annika, Lexi, and Shan Shan Fang. So, Carlos, that's all I have. I think you got about a minute to go to wrap up.
30 seconds we have. Well, back 90 minutes. Right. Things That wraps up another week of the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf, and thank you for listening to us for the past hour. Special thanks to our VIG, Jim Nugent, and Steve Mona, the CEO of the World Golf Foundation, for the practice range. Don't forget to join us again next week. Hear us here on Block Talk Radio. If you missed us, on TuneIn or download on iTunes. My name is Carlos Torres. Along with Fred Alvader, we wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.